with a low in the mid-60s. Then tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm Casey Gobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. And our first article will be from our April issue. This is part of the state. Being Texan, it's In Memoriam by R.G. Ratcliffe. And this month's column is entitled King of Crude. Midland's Clayton Williams won big in the oil business, but a joke about rape in the midst of his failed 1990 gubernatorial bid forever branded him in the eyes of Texas. There was never enough for Midland oilman Clayton Williams, never enough crude and gas to extract, never enough ranch land to graze, never enough groundwater to exploit, never enough wealth. Money is how you keep score, he once told journalist and social critic Vance Packard. By that measure, Williams was a winner when he died in February at age 88, having reportedly walked away with $1.3 billion from the 2017 sale of his oil company. Yet Clady, as he was widely called, is better known among Texans for losing the 1990 gubernatorial election to Ann Richards, the last Democrat to occupy the governor's mansion. At a campaign event following his GOP primary win, he made an offhand joke about rape to the assembled press. The remark branded him as a clueless good old boy, and his big lead in the polls evaporated. By election day, Williams' reputation was that of an uncouth buffoon. Still, he was easily likable. Dark brown eyes often sparkled, and his broad smile encouraged you to trust him. In 1954, animal husbandry graduate of Texas A&M University, Williams wept at the sound of the Aggie wore him. In his first business, selling life insurance policies, he boasted that he could get husbands to give up some beer money so that after they died, their wives could afford to live happily ever after with other men. Next, he became a broker, buying natural gas and reselling it at a profit. The venture earned him enough money to invest in drilling his own wells. He set about building an empire, and at one time, his company was the largest independent operator in Texas. A plaza and an office tower in Midland bear the moniker Clay Desta, a mashup of his name and that of his second wife, Modesta. There also were ranches where he planted a hybrid grass developed at Texas A&M for his Brangus cattle. Williams always wanted people to like him, so he was stung by a 1985 Texas Monthly article in which his neighbors complained he was wasting precious water to keep his grass green and to reduce the dust on the roads of his ranch lest it trouble the wealthy bidders attending his lavish annual cattle auction. Williams believed land was intended for human exploitation. He'd been raised on a farm near Fort Stockton where his father, Clayton Wheat Williams Sr., pumped so much groundwater that he dried up Comanche Springs. Clady Jr. became known statewide in 1984 when he launched Claydesta Communications, one of Texas's first wireless telecommunications companies, and was its chief busker in television commercials that played up his cowboy image. Following year, when legislation to deregulate AT&T threatened his competitive position, he galloped a horse up the lawn of the state capitol for a news conference opposing the bill. He won the legislative battle, but at the end of that year, Saudi Arabia glutted the world oil market and the price of West Texas crude plummeted. Savings and loan institutions across Texas went bankrupt. Unemployment statewide rose to 9% by the end of 1986. Williams was forced to sell Claydesta Communications and his original gas company to pay down $500 million in debt. Even though the oil bust halved his worth, he still had $116 million to feed the political bug that had bit him as he lobbied the legislature. For a man like Clady, that meant running for the top job, governor. The core issue for his campaign grew out of his son's struggle with drug addiction. Williams promised to impose the death penalty for dealers of illicit drugs who caused the deaths of children. He wanted to set up a boot camp for youthful offenders so they could learn the joys of busting rocks. He poured millions of dollars of his own money into television ads to push that message, and the line became ubiquitous. In his speeches, he would mention the boot camps, say he was going to teach them, and then paused with his hand cupped to his ear as that salesman's grin spread across his face. On cue, the audience would holler back, "The joys of busting rocks!" In the Republican primary, March 1990, Williams swept aside three mainstream politicians, grabbing 60% of the vote. Meanwhile, Richards survived a brutal Democratic primary fight against State Attorney General Jim Maddox. The bright West Texas stars seemed aligned to make Clady the next governor. To celebrate, his campaign decided to invite the Austin News Corps out to the ranch for a calving roundup. I was there to witness how badly it went, all because of fog. Private jets shuttled a pack of journalists from Austin to Alpine, where we were spending the night. We were up around 4 a.m. on March 24th, 1990, to ride out to the Happy Cove Ranch. The Brangus calves were to be herded into a corral for castration and branding, and that turned out to be a metaphor for what was about to happen to Clady's campaign. Three decades on, you may hear slightly differing reports from those present about the events of that day. My memory is that a thick fog had enveloped the ranch, and all we could see through the windows of the Suburban taking us there was a bit of dirt roads, shrub, and an occasional jackrabbit sprinting away. One of the journalist-filled vehicles got separated from the convoy and was lost for hours. The rest of us arrived at a large fire pit where cowboys were cooking steak and egg for our breakfast alongside a large pot of beans. There was no sign of Clady or Modesta. Time started dragging by. The fog was so thick that the men in the group, who wandered several dozen feet away from the fire to relieve themselves, were able to find their way back only by following the sound of voices. By the time the fog thinned and daylight began illuminating the land around us, I was sitting on a log, starting to nod back to sleep. That was when Clady and Modesta came striding down the hill. They wore chaps, padded coats, and well-worn cowboy hats. Modesta saw the female journalists and announced, "If y'all need a bathroom, the house is at the top of the hill." The women raced en masse toward the mansion. Dead air made Clady nervous. He was an obsessive talker. He began carrying on about the weather and the fog, and how we couldn't start until the fog lifted. Otherwise, we would miss calves in gullies and have to do the entire roundup over again. He filled a blue tin cup with beans, sat down on a metal folding chair, rocked back on the hind legs, and kept talking between bites. "Nothing to be done but wait," he said. "Another cup of coffee, another cup of beans. Bad weather's like rape," he said. "If it's inevitable, just relax and enjoy it." One of his aides instantly snapped, "That was off the record." "Huh? Was there a ground rule about the event that we'd missed?" It was enough to create a few minutes of confusion, during which Williams left for the roundup. By the time we'd all agreed we were on the record, the women had returned and been filled in on what Clady had said. We wouldn't have a chance to confront him until dinner that night at an Alpine steakhouse. By then, the comment was already national news, thanks to the Associated Press, with myself and two other male reporters as the official witnesses. When we asked Williams about the remark, he was apologetic to anyone who had been offended, but he was not contrite. It was just a joke made among men at a campfire. "That's not a Republican women's club that we were at this morning," he said. "It's a working cow camp, a tough world where you can get kicked in the testicles if you're not careful." The hashtag MeToo generation may be amazed that Williams' campaign didn't collapse immediately or even the following month when he admitted to patronizing prostitutes as a young man because it was the only way to get serviced in the West Texas of the 50s. Even today, the rape joke is often cited as the cause of his loss. It wasn't. Well, not the only reason, at least. Nearly 6 months after he made the remark, Williams led Richards in a Houston Chronicle statewide poll 48-33%. That might be because versions of the joke had been shockingly common. I'd heard it before in my high school locker room. In 1976, the National Organization for Women organized a protest against a New York City television station when a weatherman told the joke on air. Just 2 years before Williams made national headlines, famed basketball coach Bobby Knight likewise received widespread criticism for uttering it during a network TV interview. As the 1990 general election began, Texas remained in the midst of a recession, even if the worst was over. Oilmen had gone broke. New office towers sat empty. Clady ran to, quote, make Texas great again, and promised to govern with traditional values. Meanwhile, Richards envisioned a new Texas that broke the good old boys network and empowered black and Hispanic voters as well as women. She was politically savvy. He was naive. Williams once told me politics is a, quote, parlor game for adults. Richards was famous for saying Texas politics is a contact sport. She was about to teach him the joy of having his rocks busted. Richards cast Williams as a chauvinist. Rape is not a joke. It is a crime of violence, she told a gathering of Democratic women. It is time we had a governor in the state of Texas who recognized that women are not cattle, that they are not there for servicing. Meanwhile, Clady didn't do himself any favors with his public remarks. When the Richards campaign predicted that she was closing a gap, Williams quipped that he hoped she, quote, hasn't started drinking again. He also bragged that he was going to, quote, head her and hoof her and drag her through the mud. Then Richards started comparing Williams' businesses to those of New York developer Donald Trump. The guy's a Donald Trump in a cowboy hat, selling one failing business to shore up another, said campaign manager Mary Beth Rogers. Clady defended his business and said he was proud he had shown integrity rather than using Trumpian tactics like junk bonds and bankruptcies to solve his problems. But Richards' attacks kept coming, especially about questionable lending practices at Claydesta National Bank. At a Dallas event they both attended, Clady refused to shake Ann's hand. At that time in Texas, a serious breach of the unwritten rules of chivalry started to lose the support of Republican women. Final straw had nothing to do with gender. Throughout the campaign, Richards and the media had demanded that Williams release his tax returns. He refused. On the Friday before the election, a reporter asked Williams if there was ever a year when he hadn't paid taxes. Sure, he replied, in 1986, the year of the oil bust. Here was a wealthy oil man who had poured $8 million of his own money into what now looked like a vanity race for governor. And just 4 years earlier, he paid no federal income taxes. It turns out he's not such a red-hot businessman after all, Richards told a group of Dallas supporters. Her campaign quickly churned out a radio commercial. Millions of average Texans pay taxes while he took advantage of loopholes for the rich, the ad said. We ended up paying our share and his. And Richards won. As Williams conceded defeat, some of his supporters chanted for him to run for governor again in 1994. I'm an Aggie, Williams replied, but I'm not crazy. Ann's new Texas turned out to be as fragile as the fog that once enveloped the Happy Cove Ranch. She served only one term, and then Republicans came in to dominate Texas politics. Evangelical religious conservatives and Tea Party politics pushed Texas further right. Richards endured, though, as an icon. There were documentaries and plays about her. Clady faded back to Midland as the man who told the joke. That was a tough chew for Williams, a man who cared deeply about what people thought of him. The rape joke branded him for the rest of his life. Republican presidential candidate John McCain had to cancel a 2008 fundraiser hosted by Williams because of political blowback. In 2017, someone spray-painted a version of the joke onto the steps of the Clayton W. Williams Jr. Alumni Center on Texas A&M University campus. If there was a list of stupid things politicians had said about sex or rape, Clady's comment almost always led the list. The joke featured prominently in seemingly every obituary written about the oil man. The times changed, but Clady never caught up. Never really understood why his quip wasn't funny beyond his circle of longtime associates. He once told the Midland newspaper that he tried to use humor to get past hardships. The only place a sense of humor does not apply is politics. still in state, we turn now to Meanwhile in Texas. It's a collection of headlines and news stories, briefs that came across the wire services, et cetera, across Texas this month, put together by Leif Ragstad. A squirrel terrorized a Cypress neighborhood, inflicting bite wounds that sent two people to the hospital. The Mars Wrigley Confectionery Plant in Waco unveiled the world's largest Snickers bar, which is 12 feet long and weighs 4,728 pounds. A Flint woman and her daughter were charged with stalking after they allegedly used witchcraft and demonic items to scare an ex-girlfriend of the woman's husband. Hundreds of vultures made their home on a U.S. Customs and Border Protection radio tower in Kingsville, much to the chagrin of border officials who have to deal with the birds' frequent vomiting and defecation. The co-owner of a pet food distributor in Minster pledged to eat nothing but dog food for 30 days. After he was fired from a Dallas restaurant, a man allegedly picked up a sword the staff used to cut open champagne bottles and began to swing it around. An administrator at Arlington's Oak Ridge School donated a kidney to the father of three of her students. A San Antonio couple named their baby after an HEB cashier who helped them feel less stressed about the pregnancy by joking that the mother appeared to be hiding a watermelon under her shirt. An Austin woman gave birth to a baby girl during her older child's academic award ceremony. And a Houston family that claimed their daughter's Elsa doll might be haunted because it kept showing up in their house after they threw it away, mailed it to a friend in Minnesota who then taped it to his Jeep's brush guard. All right, we turn now to one of our feature articles, and this one is entitled The Aftermath. This is by Robert Draper. In 1978, an eighth grader from a prominent Austin family killed his teacher. More than four decades later, his classmates are still haunted by what happened that terrible day and after. After years of counseling and prayer, John Ray decided he had finally developed the emotional fortitude to revisit the formative trauma of his youth. He started a private Facebook group titled simply Murchison/Mr. Grayson 40 years later, and invited former classmates and teachers to join. Ray wasn't entirely sure how his outreach would be received. He knew only that he couldn't confront the past alone. For one thing, Ray barely remembered the details of that day, May 18, 1978, when a friend at his Austin Junior High walked into class and in front of Ray and 20 other eighth graders shot and killed their teacher, Wilbur Rod Grayson. In fact, Ray barely remembered a single thing about that entire year. Much of it had been buried in the far reach of his subconscious, where over the years it had massed like a tumor. Ray, now 53, lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas, with his wife and three daughters. He, as an ordained non-denominational minister, he is decidedly unorthodox. He tends to preach outdoors in natural settings. He wears cowboy boots and an untucked denim shirt. And he has a Christ-like mane of hair. He spends much of his time offering spiritual solace to those who experience trauma, people who, according to Ray, have suffered and know my suffering and will call me on my bullshit. It occurred to him that he might be able to comfort his Murchison Junior High classmates even as he leaned on them. So in February 2018, Ray created the Facebook group, and he waited. Several of his classmates who had been in the room that morning didn't respond to Ray's invitation, but others, including some who hadn't witnessed the shooting, thanked him for initiating the collective remembrance. Many shared memories of Mr. Grayson, as they still called him, How he had once taken the entire class to New Orleans to see a King Tut exhibit. How he had helped his students launch a magazine called Serendipity Doodah. How he was sharp and interesting and challenged us to think outside our normal convention. Someone posted a 40-year-old newspaper clipping with the headline, Gifted Student Shoots Teacher, and beneath it a photograph of their 13-year-old classmate shielding his face from cameras. That was such a traumatic time, a former student wrote. I was on the field just outside the window when it happened. It was such a defining moment in my life, added Marilyn Eichenbaum Duvon, Grayson's teaching partner at Murchison. Someone posted a chart that Mitsuno Bauermeister, now living in Northern California, had painstakingly diagrammed days after the tragedy of where each of them was sitting when the shooter stepped through the doorway. Overwhelmed by the torrent of memories, Ray announced to the Facebook group in March that he would be traveling to Austin a few days before the anniversary of the shooting for a previously planned writing workshop. He asked if anyone wanted to meet up. Someone suggested they visit Grayson's gravesite. Several classmates agreed to gather there. The morning of May 18th, after finishing his workshop, Ray climbed into his burnt orange Honda Element. He headed to a local coffee shop where he'd planned to meet a few classmates before driving to the cemetery, and on the way, he heard on NPR that there had been another school shooting in Texas, in the town of Santa Fe, south of Houston. In an instant, a familiar sensory pandemonium overtook him. His fingers and toes began to tingle. His breathing became shallow. His eyes darted around in search of airplanes plummeting from the sky, a jarring hallucination he'd experienced before. He was a 13-year-old boy again, panicked that he was about to be killed. Just as quickly, he jolted back to the present, but the images and sensations continued to ricochet inside him as he arrived at the coffee shop. He hadn't seen his old classmates in years, and they hugged and tearfully greeted one another. As they caught up, someone inevitably brought up the students at Santa Fe High School. Great, Ray thought. Now a whole other generation gets to spend the next 40 years of their lives dealing with this shit. Eventually, they drove together to Assumption Cemetery on the south side of Austin. One of them brought a towel and some cleanser to scrub their teacher's gravestone. Another brought flowers. For an hour, five of them stood on the dry, unshaded ground, offering words of thanks to the man who had remained frozen in their memory as their 29-year-old teacher. Ray spoke to him directly. Thank you for what you did for us. Only later in the evening, when they gathered for beers at a bar in our old neighborhood of Northwest Hills, did someone ask the question that was on all of their minds. Has anybody heard from John? Ray listened to the others recite the latest report about their former classmate, the shooter, John Christian, the son of President Lyndon B. Johnson's former press secretary, George Christian. He lives a few blocks from here. He's practicing law. Someone saw him recently. What do people say about him? Is he normal? For Ray's part, the last he had seen of John was when his friend had disappeared in the backseat of a police car. Yet John continued to hover over his life like a spectral question mark, both inexplicable and utterly familiar. He wasn't some monster you could easily explain away, Ray said later. Hell, he was one of us. Ray spent the rest of the evening at the home of a former classmate who'd settled in Northwest Hills. The two of them smoked late into the night, and their conversation resumed the next morning. Talking about it lessened the burden. Still, there were so many questions about the shooting for which they had no answers. Later, Ray went outside and pulled his bicycle from his Honda. Cycling had become one of his preferred forms of therapy, and he went for a long ride that day south to Barton Springs. There he floated in the cold, clear water, feeling momentarily light. The Austin of 1978 was smaller, simpler city, contentedly lacking in renown. Back then, houses were affordable, traffic manageable. It was also the case that an adolescent boy could, in broad daylight, during the morning rush hour, walk along a suburban street and down a grassy hill to school carrying a Browning 22 caliber rifle, and nobody would think to stop him. School shootings were not a concern then, not in Austin, not anywhere. 1978 killing of Rod Grayson wasn't the first murderous intrusion into the sanctity of American schools. It did not plunge the entire city into terror the way Charles Whitman's rampage from the University of Texas Tower had 12 years earlier, nor did it match in sheer bloodshed the later infamy bestowed upon campuses that we now recite as a mournful litany. Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Umpqua, Santa Fe. Yet to those who experienced the shooting at Murchison Junior High, it remains, even after four decades, mercilessly unforgettable. This is particularly true for the 21 witnesses of the shooting, eight of whom I spoke with, for Rod Grayson's widow, Laura, whom I also interviewed, and for the killer, John Christian, who did not respond to repeated interview requests. The anguish that has plagued the Murchison students presages the kind of long-tailed trauma that many of today's witnesses to shootings will be burdened with for the rest of their lives. According to the Washington Post, more than 240,000 U.S. students have experienced a school shooting since 1999. But no school shooting is quite the same. Peculiarities form the contours of the Murchison shooting. For one, there's the trajectory of John Christian, from gifted student to teenage killer to middle-aged tax attorney, quietly working and living in Austin today. There's also the manner in which the collateral victims were dealt with, or more precisely, not dealt with. Many of the details surrounding the incident and its aftermath have gone unreported, leaving the victims with unanswered questions that have derailed their own attempts at recovery. It's all just speculation, Peyton Smith, one of the students present in that classroom, told me in his Austin law office last September. So as a result, I just have to process what I've got. Look at the jigsaw puzzle, and there are huge pieces that are not there. Thinking back to that distant morning, Smith began to describe his proximity to his teacher. He had been the nearest student to Grayson when the shooting began. Then, as we spoke, he started to cry. Lives were shattered, Smith said. Lives were changed. Every person in that room was a victim. That's a natural spot here to take a break. Remind you quickly that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Broadcasting since 1967. Now we're getting back to our article. This is the aftermath. It's about a school shooting in Austin, 1978. We open the remainder here with a quote from Rebecca Lehman, a student of Grayson's. I used to have a recurring dream that I was surrounded by people who seemed to think everything is fine, and I was trying to tell them that it isn't. When Rod Grayson interviewed on June 20th, 1977, for the job of teaching the gifted and talented students of Murchison Junior High, he was an unemployed 28-year-old. His wife, Laura, herself a teacher at Austin's LBJ High School, had given birth to their son, Ian, earlier that day. Unlike his father, an employee at Humble Oil, who at first had not approved of Rod's marriage to a Mexican-American, he was a free spirit who wrote poetry, smoked marijuana, and had ambitions of becoming a professional actor. But Laura's pregnancy had scuttled such notions, and he went looking for a steady paycheck. After getting his teaching certificate, he had applied for the Murchison opening. Pilot Program's coordinator, Marilyn Eichenbaum, now Dubon, saw his potential right away. Even though he had no experience teaching, I could tell he would provide the right fodder for these kids, she said. He was a strapping young man with a keen mind and great energy. Nearly all the students Grayson taught during what would be his only two semesters as a full-time educator lived in the neighborhood of Northwest Hills. Situated at what was back then the northern edge of the city, the neighborhood was populated with doctors, bankers, professors, restaurateurs, and pastors. Murchison's student body was overwhelmingly white and socioeconomically privileged. 29 children were hand-picked for Eichenbaum's and Grayson's classes. These students were deemed exceptional, not because they had high grades, but because they seemed to possess a certain creative spark. Whatever his earlier aspirations had been, Grayson found his calling as a Pied Piper to these brainy adolescents. Sitting on a stool, he began class with a meditation exercise. Then he would instruct his students to write a free-form essay or short story based on a poem he would read aloud or a curious drawing he had sketched on a blackboard. He was demanding. Susie Jerry Davis remembers his insisting on several revisions for a written assignment, telling her, "I think you could do something pretty important with this gift of yours, and that's why I'm requiring so much work from you." Davis has since become the author of several faith-based books. Two other students turned in a project that Grayson considered sloppy, and he ripped our shit apart, one of them recalled, which was crushing, but also fantastic, yet super high standards. At the same time, the handsome and witty young teacher, "I think every girl had a crush on him, including me," said one student, was an attentive, empathic, big brother figure. Rebecca Lehman remembered how Grayson gently encouraged her to challenge her shyness. Logan Bazar recalled how the teacher regularly let him out of class 5 minutes early so that he could avoid being jumped by two bullies. And Andre Terry, one of Murchison's few African-American students who was bused to school from the East Side, would one day credit his junior high school teacher for pushing him to follow his artistic impulses and become a fashion designer. "He was like no other teacher I ever had," Terry said. "He was a friend." Though Grayson resisted playing favorites, he became especially close with one student in particular who shared his love of stage acting, John Christian. If there was a Murchison student destined for great things, it was John. According to his classmates, he was the smartest one in the whole group, a great student and a really good artist, with a wry wit who drew political cartoons that could have been in any newspaper. His preternatural maturity meant that he always got cast as the older person in the school plays, and he dressed like a grown-up, often in a striped short-sleeved shirt and crisp slacks. Though the tall, slender, floppy-haired boy seldom spoke up in class except to correct someone else's error, John seemed immune to the self-doubt that consumed his peers. "Everyone knew John. He cut a figure," said Logan Bazar, one of his closest friends at Murchison. "John and I bonded on the soccer field. We played backfield a lot because we were both bad. We hung back and prayed. The ball didn't come our way. They gave it some time to talk. I felt lucky that he found any interest in me because he was so much smarter and worldlier. We were all interested in women, but he wasn't the uninformed idiot I was. He'd read Erica Jong and told me that it took women 7 minutes to reach orgasm. He'd done some reading on Hitler and the Nazis, which wasn't uncommon for boys our age. He took the time to learn things." Then there was John's pedigree. His father was George Christian, a legendary figure in Texas politics. He'd served as President Johnson's press secretary and later became a top advisor to Governor Dolph Briscoe. John's mom, Joanne, was an accomplished lawyer and patron of Austin's art scene. John was the third of their four sons. George had two adult daughters from a previous marriage. The family occupied a sprawling house on Rockledge Cove, a short walk from the Murchison campus, with an enormous magnolia tree in the front yard that had grown from a sapling given to them by Lady Bird Johnson. The Christians weren't rich by Texas standards, but they had forged elaborate social and professional ties to power brokers and superachievers that extended well beyond Texas. Of course, few Murchison students paid much attention to such distinctions, nor was it the habit of adolescents to speculate on anyone's psychological burdens apart from their own. Unless, that is, they were confided in, as Bazar was by John. "His dad was the main topic of conversation," said Bazar. "I would remember this even if nothing had happened, because it was a constant theme in John's life, the pressure he felt from his dad and the absolute lack of grace, it seemed, that he lived with. I think John had reached a point where he was never going to be good enough, and that year he was growing more and more bitter about his father." In reality, George and Joanne, both of them smart, stubborn, and overextended from all their obligations, according to John's older brother, George Scott, were likelier to be distracted parents than dictatorial ones. Both were busy during all hours of the day. At night, according to George Scott, they sometimes argued heatedly. Their father didn't have that much emotional range. He was always either kind of happy or kind of pissed. Even in his more upbeat moments, recalled the elder son, George was an emotionally distant patriarch, one who, like most men of his generation, avoided talking about feelings or the traumas of his own youth, such as the death of George's father when he was quite young. Above all, after years on the government payroll, George had a private political consulting business to run, and while George Scott recalled his own childhood with fondness, John's experience might well have been different. The origins of John's mental illness are unknowable. 2 years before the shooting, a sixth grade classmate noticed that John had sketched a scene of a mass shooting with red flames leaping out of the gun. At one point in eighth grade, he urged a female classmate to play a game with him. There was someone on the school payphone John wanted her to talk to, a man who was threatening to jump from the top of a skyscraper. The man's initials were J.C. Playing along, the girl picked up the phone and spoke a few reassuring words to the non-existent person on the other end. John thanked her, saying that the man named J.C. was comforted by what she said. A few weeks before the shooting, Grayson was at home grading papers when he handed one of them to his wife and said, "Tell me what you think about this." It was a short story written by John. Laura gazed at it in disbelief. The story, written in unsparingly graphic language, was about robots that prowled the streets and castrated men. She handed back the paper, slack-jawed. Her husband nodded and offered a sad smile. He'd been concerned about John. "His parents expect a lot from him," he said. Ever since then, whenever I walk into an unfamiliar place, I'm always looking for a way out, because I was in the back of the classroom. I felt trapped. Elaine Moore, a student of Grayson's. The tragedy was set in motion by happenstance. The morning before, on May 17, 1978, Rod and Laura Grayson noticed that Ian was running a fever. It was Rod's turn to stay home with the baby, so he called Murchison and requested a substitute teacher for his classes, beginning with GT English. The agenda for that day had already been set. Two of the students, John Christian and John Ray, would be giving an oral presentation of a chapter from Harriet Beecher Stowe's classic novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. To the astonishment of his classmates, the normally reserved John Christian proceeded to enter an alternate universe that bore no relationship to Stowe's novel. He began hollering loudly, profanely. He flung his arms about and jumped several times in the air. He said something about the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He whirled to a chalkboard and drew a couple in bed together, and then, whirling back to face the room, said, "Whoever can make the S sound the longest can win this piece of chalk." The class erupted in raucous laughter. John, their quiet resident genius, had come out of his shell. Meanwhile, the substitute teacher glowered and scribbled away in his notebook. After the bell rang, Ray, who had stood helplessly off to the side while his classmate went on his manic riff, muttered, "John, when Mr. Grayson hears about this, he's going to kick our butts." "Don't worry," John replied. "I'm going to bring a gun tomorrow." He wasn't laughing. Still, it had to be a joke, Ray thought. Yeah, I'm going to bring one, too," Ray exclaimed. The two of them then walked across the hall into the classroom of Eichenbaum, who recalled, "John went directly from that substitute teacher to me, and there was nothing at all memorable about his behavior." But two things had happened that might have signaled John's downward spiral. That same day, John reportedly destroyed a map he had designed for school assignment. Psychiatrist later testified at his trial that he had begun to take pleasure in succumbing to violent impulses. That afternoon, his math teacher, Anita Sebesma, reminded him that he was doing poorly in algebra. She warned him that he needed to study hard for the upcoming test. "If you don't pass it," she said, "you'll fail the class." The prospect of failure loomed. The next morning, while the rest of his family filed out the front door to their respective daily destinations, John stayed behind, hiding in a closet. When they were gone, he stepped out into the empty house. According to psychiatrists who questioned him later, he contemplated killing himself with the Browning 22 caliber hunting rifle that his parents had given him for Christmas. Instead, without any sort of a plan, he walked outside, across the lawn, under the canopy of oaks and the great magnolia tree, and onto the sidewalk. It was a curious spectacle, one that Americans had not yet come to dread. A young white man with a firearm. Class had already started without him. What transpired next is based on the recollections of 8 eyewitnesses in the classroom as well as those of others at school that day. Sitting as he always did, not behind his desk but on his stool directly in front of him, Grayson had begun by asking his students what the hell had happened the previous day. They glumly acknowledged their own misbehavior. they added. But Mr. Grayson, John was acting so weird. Teacher waved them off. You just don't understand in the way I do, he said. Then, where is John anyway? There he is, someone exclaimed, directing their attention to a figure outside the classroom window who was heading down the grassy hill beside the football field. And, someone else said, he's got a gun. What occurred in the next 2 minutes would be remembered through trauma's kaleidoscope. But as all the eyewitnesses I spoke with took pains to explain, the sight of John with a hunting rifle was a momentarily bemusing one. It's a skit. John and Mr. Grayson planned all this. This is going to be great. John stepped into the doorway. Seeing him, Grayson may have smiled, maybe even have laughed. Okay, John, joke's over. John held the gun at his hip, pointed at his teacher. A classmate heard him say, the joke's on you. He shot Grayson 3 times in the arm, chest, and forehead. Grayson fell from his stool and collided with the student desk in front of him, where Peyton Smith sat. Then his tall, lean body thudded heavily to the floor. The next sound might well have been unsteady applause, since many, if not most of the students, were still convinced that they had witnessed an exquisitely executed dramatic performance. But the puff of gun smoke prompted Smith to look more closely at his teacher. Blood poured out of one of his ears. His eyes were wide open. He looked terrified. As John turned and walked out without another word, the classroom exploded into screams. Smith was the first one out the door. He ran to the principal's office and told the administrators at the front desk what had just happened. No one seemed to believe him. Then for the first time in his life, Smith, whose father, Ralph Smith, was a pastor at Hyde Park Baptist Church, yelled out the Lord's name in vain. God damn it, he killed him. Eichenbaum was outside the office when she heard the screams from the classroom and at first laughed to herself. Oh, Lord, what's Rod got his kids doing now? Then they were clinging to her, sobbing hysterically. She led several of them into a nurse's examination room and told them to stay there. Gym class had been underway outside by the football field. A few kids saw John toss the firearm against the bicycle rack and then run up the slope. Coach Larry Sherpick saw this as well. His knee was healing from surgery, so he ambled to his truck and gave chase. He caught up to John at the top of the hill. Jumping out of his truck and grabbing the boy, Sherpick barked, "What did you do?" I shot Mr. Grayson, John said. Sherpick drove him back to school and led him by his arm into the principal's office. Joanne Christian materialized in the administrative office, her palms flat on the counter as she demanded, "Where's John?" Soon the Austin police arrived. The local media began to swarm the school as well. They shouted out questions as Grayson's students were herded into a school bus that would take them to police headquarters to be interviewed. Some of the students extended their middle fingers to the press in hopes of stopping them from taking pictures. As the bus pulled away, one of them noticed other Murchison students in their classrooms, faces pressed against the windows, staring. On the way to the police station, someone spontaneously led the group in singing church hymns. John's older brother, George Scott, was pulled from class at his high school and instructed to drive home. Passing by Murchison on the way, he saw his father walking hurriedly downhill to the school. The look on George's face was a devastating sight the son would one day write in an autobiographical essay. At that moment, the veneer of the public figure had been stripped away, exposing the anguished soul of a father whose son had cried out for help in an unspeakably violent and destructive act. John was led out of the school building by police, and he hid his face from the cameras. After seeing his son whisked off in a squad car, George headed to the police station. There, a reporter saw him sitting on a bench, visibly shaken. Eventually, he went home, where several friends and family members met him. James Knapp, a reporter from the Austin American Statesman, rang a doorbell. Former press secretary told the reporter that his son, quote, got the weapon here at the house, I guess. I don't know. He also said, I don't want to say anything that might hurt my boy. George asked Knapp about the school teacher had been shot. Did he have a family? When Neff replied that Grayson and his wife had an 11-month-old son, the reporter watched as something seemed to collapse inside the father. Meanwhile, Laura Grayson arrived at Brackenridge Hospital. A gurney rolled past her as she pulled over the body, but she could see Rod's cowboy boots poking out. He'd been so proud of those stupid things, she never understood why. Back at the police station, Grayson's students were ushered into a room where investigators asked each of them questions. The children, though, had questions of their own. Above all, is Mr. Grayson okay? They weren't told anything. Some of them, assuming he had survived, were hoping to visit their teacher in the hospital. One overheard a cop tell another he didn't make it. On the drive back home, Susie Jerry Davis learned from her mother that Grayson had died. She screamed and contemplated throwing herself out of the car onto the highway. Logan Bazar, who hadn't been present during the shooting, was dispatched to Grayson's classroom to receive his personal effects. He could see that someone had tried to wipe away the blood, but traces remained. John Ray came home to a shattering quiet. Seared into his brain were two images. His friend John walking into the classroom with a rifle in his hand and his teacher lying on the ground in a pool of blood. He asked himself, what now? That evening at the Grayson home, a teacher's friend stood on the front lawn and handled all the visiting reporters. At some point, one of Rod's brothers began looking through his papers, and he happened to pick up the disturbing story John had written about the castrating robots. He brought it to Laura, who threw it away, and she would later say, at that point, as a mother, as a teacher, as a human being, as pained as I was that Rod was dead, I felt sorry for that kid. I didn't want that story to get out. Wow. Man, I'm just now remembering. I had this recurring dream. It started after the shooting. That movie, Dawn of the Dead, had just come out. I dreamed that John Christian was leading this big group of zombies from the projects near where I lived. They'd come over the hill and killed everyone around me. You know, I consider myself to be a pretty strong-minded person, but after talking about all this, I've been in a very weird state of mind. I can't really describe it. It's a quote from Andre Carey, another student of Grayson's. A few days after the shooting, Bazar visited his friend at the Gardner Betts Juvenile Detention Facility in South Austin. Can you believe it? John asked, referring to the shoelaces and belt that the authorities had taken from him for fear that he might attempt suicide. The two boys sat in the cafeteria. John seemed caustic and above it all, qualities that Bazar had under very different circumstances once found attractive. During that half-hour conversation, John took issue with a report in the media that he had said, "The joke's on you," before shooting Grayson. "There were only two people close enough to hear what I said," John remarked, "and one of them isn't talking." For years, Bazar would be haunted by this conversation. Why did John seem so unaffected? No one, including the Christian family, was disputing that he had intentionally killed Grayson. Still, as a juvenile, he could not be charged with murder and tried as an adult. Worst John could expect, under state juvenile laws, that would be toughened during the 90s. He would be judged guilty of delinquent conduct and confined to a Texas Youth Commission facility until he turned 18. The new Travis County District Attorney, Ronald Earle, publicly announced that he intended to seek the 5-year maximum if the boy is found sane. Though juvenile trials are not typically open to the media, an exception was made in this case. Those with first-hand knowledge of why an exception was made have died, declined to be interviewed, or simply cannot recall. Christians hired the city's most prominent criminal defense attorney, Roy Minton. John's fate rested in the hands of the state district judge, Hume Coper, a by-the-book jurist who is not regarded as a softie. Austin was a small town in those days, so it was no surprise that Judge Coper, like George Christian, had an LBJ connection. His father had been Johnson's attorney following a scandal-ridden 1948 U.S. Senate race. Another connection that wasn't reported at the time. Earlier that same year, Minton had managed to get a drug charge thrown out against Coper's estranged son. It's not clear whether Earl was aware that Minton had previously represented Judge Coper's son. Earl had been ill for some time, according to his wife, Twyla, who spoke to me on his behalf. Reached by phone, Earl's assistant district attorney, Jacqueline Strachan, could not recall for sure if Coper, who died in 2016, had disclosed the association, but added, Judge Coper was a very, very straight guy, probably the most ethical judge at the time. Minton hired two psychiatrists to evaluate John and supply expert testimony. One of them, Daniel Matthews, had since been recognized as a pioneer in the therapeutic treatment of pathologically violent juveniles. The other, Richard Coons, was one of the state's most prominent psychiatric experts at criminal trials, one whose judgments often resulted in murder defendants being sent to death row. Like many Austin professionals, he knew the Christians socially. On June 2, 1978, 2 weeks after the shooting, John sat outside a small courtroom at Gardner Betts while the two psychiatrists testified inside to Judge Coper that John was acutely depressed and suffered from latent schizophrenia, the latter being an inexact catch-all term that would eventually fall out of favor in the psychiatric community. When I spoke with Coons recently, he told me, "My feeling overwhelmingly was that he was depressed." The prosecution did not contest the recommendation by Coons and Matthews that John received treatment rather than incarceration. Coper concurred with Minton's two experts. He ordered that John be remanded to the care of the Timberlawn Psychiatric Hospital, a private facility in Dallas for which the Christians would be paying the bills until his 18th birthday or until he had recovered. On Monday, June 5th, 1978, Joanne and George flew with their son and a probation officer to Dallas, where John reported to Timberlawn. Following is an excerpt of a letter that's returned to our text where Mr. Christian, young John Christian, wrote to a classmate, September 17, 1979, Monday, 5:37 p.m., Dear Elaine, it was really neat to hear from you. I have not seen you in a long time. I've been up here now for a year and 3 months, some of which has been real hell, the rest of which has really been good. I've definitely changed a lot since I came here, and it has been a really good feeling to change this way. I haven't heard from you, so I don't really know what to write. The music I'm into is the Doobie Brothers, Moody Blues, Pablo Cruz, Queen, Simon & Garfunkel, Little River Band, and The Doors, plus another 100 like Santana, Kansas Fix, Chicago, and Boston, who I think are good. I heard from Katie and now from you that you're now a disco queen. More power to you. The moves you made at the Valentine Dance in 1977 were impressive enough. I still only slow dance because I'm not too rhythmic. Doesn't take any effort to stand in one spot and go in circles. Write soon. Love, John. This is a letter to former classmate Elaine Moore from Timberlawn. It is a cornerstone of civilized societies that sharp legal distinctions are drawn between children and adults, and it is a medical fact that the adolescent brain is far from fully developed, which means, among other things, that a violent youth, even a murderous one, is not inexorably destined to a life of brutal criminality. It's especially true when no resources are spared to treat a violent adolescent, as was the case with John Christian. Timberlawn, which opened in 1917, was a national model for inpatient treatment during the time of John's residency. The population of 150 or so residents included about 30 juveniles, of whom no more than 16 in John's age range were housed in a separate dormitory. The institution offered a full academic curriculum, as well as a rigorous daily regimen of group and individual therapy with multiple mental health professionals. As Dr. Jerry Lewis III, who worked at Timberlawn from 1982 to 1994, and whose father was the chief psychiatrist during John's stay, put it, the idea was not just to use behavior modification to change a boy's aggressive antisocial behavior, but also to use psychotherapy to get him to appreciate the fact that his behaviors are attempts to ward off deep and painful feelings. So for 18 months or thereabouts, he had them confront their defense mechanisms and talk about their core issues. As they work through their core issues, it changes the driving forces behind their behavior. That approach began to recede during the 90s as Texas and other states moved toward cheaper and harsher measures to deal with juvenile violence. Timberlawn was closed in early 2018. John had been at Timberlawn for 20 months when a representative of the Christian family returned to Judge Kofor's courtroom. The representative requested that the original order to institutionalize his client be modified. The Christians asked that their son be permitted to visit Timberlawn on an outpatient basis. They proposed that the boy lived with an unnamed physician in Dallas who would become John's legal guardian. On February 19, 1990, the judge granted the request. The decision was not made public. Nearly a month passed before the Statesman reporter Guillermo Garcia was tipped off that John had moved in with the Dallas family. He began making inquiries. George agreed to meet Garcia at his office on the 18th floor of the American Bank Tower in downtown Austin. The former press secretary declined to supply information about whom his son was living with or how the determination had been made that John should be treated on an outpatient basis. He did tell Garcia that his son, quote, had to remain in Dallas for treatment, and we are, of course, not living there. Garcia also spoke to someone he described as being familiar with the case, who told him Timberlawn's psychiatrist felt that to continue the on-site care would affect a regression in the boy's mental health. Though George did not want the Statesman to publish Garcia's story, and indeed a few people representing the Christians had paid a visit to then editor-in-chief Ray Mariotti to express that very sentiment, his posture was anything but belligerent. Garcia's surprised, the typically stoic father broke down in tears. If I'd just done more for John earlier and around more, George said quietly. Garcia's story ran in the Statesman anyway. What remained unreported until now was the identity of the man who had become John's adopted father. He was a Dallas eye doctor named John Eisenlohr, who was a prominent member and later president of the Texas Ophthalmological Association, a group a group whose lobbyist was George Christian. Eisenhower's children attended Highland Park High School in the affluent community where John would spend the next 2.5 years. He enrolled at Highland Park High in the middle of his sophomore year. Rumors swirled around a quiet new student. One of his new classmates came across a newspaper story that identified John by name and described him as a schizophrenic. The classmate wondered, why is he at our school? Those concerns subsided over time. John returned to his passion, drama, and also became the news editor of the school paper, The Bagpipe. A Dallas friend of George's wrote him to say that her daughter worked on the staff of The Bagpipe and has mentioned how much she admires the work John did and how intelligent he is. The Dallas media left John alone. So did the Austin Press. John graduated from high school on schedule in May of 1982. That summer, he returned to the city of his youth and enrolled at the University of Texas at Austin. Now, we've got a little ways to go yet on this story, my friends, so we'll come back to that next time. I believe we're at the limit of our time for today. That brings us to the end of our reading. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5, Monday afternoons at 2, Sight and Sound Broadcasting, your print information source.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by audiobook news at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
All Citibank locations will modify lobby access because of the coronavirus situation. Drive-through locations will remain open during regular business hours, while lobby access will be by appointment only until further notice. The Midland location is at 400 West Illinois Avenue. Customers must make an appointment in advance to visit a lobby location. All other bank activity will be directed to drive-through locations, ATMs, online or mobile devices. For more information, call 570-8679. First Basin Credit Union is restricting services in an effort to follow the recommendation of limiting groups to 10 people or fewer. The branch at 3316 North Midland Drive will have regular lobby and drive-through hours. The branch at 5509 Andrews Highway will direct customers to the Midland Drive location.
Currently airing on the Noon Book Hour, it's Travels with Charlie in Search of America by John Steinbeck. A stunning evocation of America on the eve of a tumultuous decade, and a moving elegy for more innocent times. While we are isolating at home, we invite you with us as we take a quest across America from the northernmost tip of Maine to California's Monterey Peninsula. To hear the speech of the real America, to smell the grass and the trees, to see the colors and the light. These were John Steinbeck's goals as he set out at the age of 58 in September 1960 to rediscover the country he had been writing about for so many years. With Charlie, his French poodle, Steinbeck drives the interstates and the country roads, dines with truckers, encounters bears at Yellowstone, and old friends in San Francisco. Along the way, he reflects on the American character, racial hostility, the particular form of American loneliness he finds almost everywhere, and the unexpected kindness of strangers. Travels with Charlie in Search of America, weekdays at noon and replayed overnights at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read and travel by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 84 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg. While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From the Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas, with more than 7,000 azalea bushes, along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize Garden is transformed in another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare Hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden host other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA Garden Director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower-growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See, timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general, mid-March through early April, you should be able to enjoy the beauty of these gardens. If you come later, you may see many of the Satsuki varieties, which bloom in late April and into early June, depending on the variety. and the popular Encore series and other reblooming azaleas that produce a second wave of colorful blooms later in the year. The Disappeared Man Who Loved Azaleas by William Shike. The luxurious blooms of Hoang azalea hybrids hide a sad story about their corrector, T. Lin Hoang,